morning. First of all, I'd like to thank you for accepting transfer on this case. There are two injustices that I think have occurred. The first one was the Southern District refusing to hear this appeal, and I thank you for fixing that at this point. The second injustice involves an ex parte communication and the provision of information outside the record in an administrative proceeding under Chapter 536 RISMO. My client, Roger Worley, applied for duty-related disability benefits from the City of Springfield. He had a seven-day hearing with another attorney representing him, not me. And the attorney that represented the city in that action was Yendez. Carl Yendez participated in that proceeding as an advocate against Worley. The hearing officer ruled in favor of Worley, granting him disability benefits. The city appealed, or at any rate took it to the board to see whether they would uphold or reject the hearing officer's recommendation. And during the deliberations on that decision, Attorney Yendez participated with that board.
So Mr. Yendez represented both the city before the hearing officer and then also represented the city before the board, but also was counsel to the board at the
Apparently
same time?
So. Yes. And I was allowed to do some limited discovery in the civil, in the circuit court action. I sent interrogatories. Two of the board members responded that they had received a legal update from Yendez prior to making the decision. I requested that document, a request for documents, and the trial court ruled that that was, and Mr. Sherman objected that that was attorney-client privileged communication, and the trial court sustained it. So I found myself in the difficult position of trying to address an appeal under Chapter 536 with a board that had information outside the record that I couldn't get access to.
And was that document filed with the trial court under seal?
It was, correct.
And do we know if is it in this court as part of the record?
It is not. And I wasn't sure exactly what to do. The trial court sustained the objection. Therefore, at least theoretically, it's not even part of that case.
Well, if you want to appeal that issue, then you do so and put it before us under seal so we can look at it.
That is correct, and I should have done that. But at the time, actually what I thought was, I've got to win this case. The trial court sustained the objection on attorney-client privilege. Surely he's going to rule that there's a due process violation. And I filed a motion for summary judgment, and it was denied.
And what was it? This was the report prepared by...
The only information I had was the interrogatory. I asked, please provide any document given to you by Yendez. I'm looking at the respondent's appendix A4. Please identify any document related to your answer. Answer, no, except for legal update exhibit A, parentheses, privileged.
Okay.
And that was apparently given to them by Attorney Yendez.
And it was given to them while they were deliberating? I mean, is there a time frame as to when they received it? Was it in the April meeting?
The interrogatory, I attached the minutes from the March and the April meeting for the board members to see in responding to the interrogatory. And with that, I asked, please identify what was provided to you in writing by Attorney Yendez beyond the record itself.
So it doesn't have a time frame as to when whether they would have gotten it at the March meeting, between the meetings, or at the April meeting?
That is correct. Well,
pardon me, I
misspoke. On the second interrogatory at A24, it says legal update dated 3/10/04. So apparently that was the date of the legal update, 3/10/04, attached as Exhibit A, provided under seal.
Your opponent in the brief argues that it's not uncommon for in administrative proceedings for officials to play more than one role, and cited a case where there was someone who both investigated a claim and was the decision maker. Can you respond to that argument that we don't have quite the same standards for the roles of individuals in administrative proceedings that we might if it were a courtroom proceeding?
True. It depends on the level of formality. If you have something rising to the level of a contested case, then the provisions of Chapter 536 RISMO apply. If those provisions apply, then you have certain requirements about the board making a decision on the record. You have judicial review of the record and the decision by the board. and you have a separation of functions. The reality of it is that oftentimes you will have an attorney appointed, say, from the highway department to have an employment hearing to determine whether the employee was wrongfully terminated or not. That attorney then litigates the case, let's say against me, I'm representing the employee, which happens. Well, then when that goes to the highway department, to the commission, there's a different attorney that represents them in the commission that didn't take part in the adversarial proceeding, and there's at least a Chinese wall of some formality that gives the appearance of a fair hearing.
If we believe that your client was denied due process in this proceeding, what's the remedy?
That's a difficult question. I looked at Chapter 536 again this morning and tried to figure it out. It's unclear to me. The other cases seem to look at the issue of whether the decision makers appear to be prejudiced, where it would be inappropriate to send the decision back to this particular group to make the decision. And, you know, perhaps that's the thing to look at.
And in that case, then, is it heard and decided by the circuit court as opposed to by the agency?
No, I think.
Or is there a different agency proceeding?
The only cases that I found that seemed to address that were school board cases, and where the teacher is found to have been wrongfully terminated by the circuit court or the court of appeals, that goes back to the school board. The Teacher Tenure Act specifically provides that school boards are in the best position to select quality teachers and regulate education, and so that's their administrative.
But if I thought you were arguing that if these commissioners, because they'd gotten the ex parte information or whatever, were not able to hear it on remand, who else could hear it?
I think it would have to be them, or whatever persons are filling those roles at this time. I assume they're not the same as these gentlemen were, but I don't know. I'm afraid that's the remedy there. My feeling is that looking at the decision itself, that is reversing the hearing officer's decision by the board, is so badly done. And, you know, one of the interesting things is the adversarial process isn't perfect, and it doesn't always reach the right result. But one thing it generally does is it involves a discourse where you at least have an accurate decision that's well-reasoned. And this one is not. And I wanted to just point you to a couple of things that, well first of all, the primary reason, or the reason, that the board reversed the hearing officer was because the board found that Worley suffered from a pre-existing condition, and that pre-existing condition was the cause of his disability, irrespective of employment. Now, under the board's rules, if they reverse the hearing officer, they're required to give detailed reasons why. And in the record, you will see that we have a lengthy decision by the board in explaining some of its reasons for reversing the hearing officer.
So your major contention is the problem that the same lawyer who advocated before the board works for the board and helped the board by writing their findings for them?
Well, that's part of it. When we got the record, when I filed the 536 review case in circuit court and we got the record, it did not contain either Worley's brief, post-trial brief, or Mr. Yendez's post-trial brief. They were not in the record, so the indication was these were not before the board. But when we looked at the decision and compared it to Mr. Yendez's brief, it's a verbatim copy. So obviously there is information that's not in the record that we got that was before the board, and information that was actually in the record before the hearing officer was not before the board. That is our brief.
Well, but it even goes beyond that, because you were present before the board and you were asked to leave the proceedings, and you sat outside and could look inside. And Mr. Yendez stayed in those proceedings and participated in the deliberations when the board reached its decision.
Yes, ma'am. My predecessor. I wasn't actually there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Pardon me.
Yeah.
So it's not simply that he gave them a form for proposed judgment. He was talking with them at the time they were deliberating on the case.
That is correct. And as far as I can tell from Mr. Sherman, that is not denied. What their position is that it's okay. They have a city regulation that says that city attorneys can represent both the city and the board. the regulations have to say represent them at the same time and in the same proceeding, but that's the interpretation I think that he.
So is there any authority for us to negate the board's decision, go back to the hearing officer's decision and say the board can't cure its error here because they already got the ex parte information, to then say, oh, we decided again, even though they've been tainted, it would be impossible. Is there any authority for that?
I'd sure like to find some for you if I could. I haven't been able to, and that would be a desirable result from our perspective. I think the only thing that I can say as far as present authority out there is that the court is to make some determination about whether that finder of fact has been prejudiced to the point where they can make the decision.
And if, in fact, there is merit to your claim that your client was denied due process, then, and the matter would be remanded for a new decision by the board, then the other two points that you raise, that go to the merits of the decision, would be mooted. Is that right?
I was thinking that they could be taken up together. Even though there may have been a due process violation, if the board's decision is so faulty and so self-contradictory that it cannot stand, that I think it could be reversed on its own. And if you look at that decision, the most interesting part is really on the first and second pages. That's at legal file 63 and 64. And the board talks about how the hearing officer erred by shifting the burden of proof to the city when the city alleged that there was a pre-existing condition. Well, of course it does. That's right. If I'm going to say my client's disabled and I come forward with evidence showing that he's disabled and the other side said, no, it's a pre-existing condition, then they have the burden of proving there's a pre-existing condition. Of course. But this board says that's wrong. This board says that the hearing officer erred and shipped. I mean, that's...
You're saying as a matter of law, your client should have won.
Yes. If the issue is who had the burden of proof, I think it's... clear. And that's what this board says in its decision. It says that it was a pre-existing condition and we shouldn't have to prove it.
Isn't the standard of review for us whether or not the board's decision was supported by substantial evidence in the record?
That's the
and regardless of what the board concludes in the sense of legal conclusions, we always review those de novo. But as for the underlying claim, it's just whether or not there's substantial evidence in the record. If they adopt the hearing officer's claim, then we assume they found the facts the way they did. If they don't adopt the hearing officer's claim, we assume that they didn't believe it the way they did. But we still leave those determinations to the board.
Yes, sir, that is correct. And if I could, one of the interesting determinations that the board made at legal file 84, they said, Mr. Worley's description of the various complaints against him, et cetera, do not meet the standard of disability directly resulting from occupational duties, but more of a reaction by Mr. Worley of anxiety, stress, and depression to the normal and regular requirements of the job. Well, the statute that we apply for disability says that it arises out of the regular requirements of the job. So one of the findings that they made was that Worley actually did have disability that arose out of the regular requirements of the job. So it isn't so much factual dispute.
Are there any further questions at this point? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your time.
May it please the court. I'm Paul Sherman. It's my honor and privilege to be here on behalf of the respondents in this case. The purpose for being here is on transfer, and I understand the court's order regarding transfer. I understand Mr. Moen and I have agreement 8404 is mandatory, and I also understand the appellate court has a discretion to dismiss the appeal that doesn't comply with 8404. That was the determination of the Southern District, and I happen to agree with that determination. The reason is, as I read the court's opinion, they didn't have what they needed to do their job, neither did I.
Well, you were able to file a responsive brief.
I did file a responsive brief, I did. But when you look at 8404I, it says should have framed the specific references to the facts that you're asserting in your statement of facts and the argument you're asserting in your brief. When I go through the appellant's brief, there's no reference to any statements in any legal file anywhere in his argument, with possibly two exceptions. There's no page reference to tie it up. To me, it read like he's saying these things happened without reference to the record so that I could check out why he says that or makes that claim.
Did you file a separate motion to dismiss before you prepared your responsive brief?
I included it in what I filed to dismiss, yes, with the court appeals. In my brief in response, I raised motion to dismiss, and then I went forward and argued.
So you submitted them contemporaneously after you'd written your brief?
I submitted them contemporaneously.
Of course, we have the briefs here. It might, because you're limited time, you might want to address some of the issues about due process that were raised
I'm
by opposing counsel.
Thank you. Regarding the posed question of due process, I could talk about Cochran. The Cochran case we cited.
Talk to me why it's okay in a contested case to have the same counsel represent the city and represent the decision maker in the same case and to be in on the deliberations, but not to have counsel for the opposing side there, and why we would respect, give any kind of deference to a decision that was made in that kind of circumstance.
I'd be happy to. Thank you. My reading of Cochran was in my brief, and there are other cases cited, and our own rules of the board operate that we have a city attorney who is counsel to the board, and that was Mr. Yendez. He performs in that capacity for the board purposes. The board heard this matter as originally applied and granted non-duty disability, denied the duty disability. There was exercise for a hearing officer to conduct the hearing. His name is Dennis Budd, and they did so. Mr. Yendez represented the board.
The board of trustees you're talking about now.
That's right.
Okay.
In that hearing, he's the city attorney. He handles and wears a couple
of different
hats.
Who did he represent, though? But he can't wear this, a lot of hats in the same case. He's got, which hat was he wearing in this case?
In this case, he was representing the, before the hearing officer, Bud, he was representing the opposing side to Mr. Worley's application.
He was representing the city.
Right.
Because the trustees are both the entity and the decision maker.
What he has done is done every day in municipalities throughout our state, as I read Cochran and the other cases I cited, and I add, it was never objected to.
But this is a due process issue. I mean,
I agree.
What did he not object when he was, well.
That's right.
He didn't know that he was representing both of them until he observed him in the deliberations with the board.
Okay.
There's no indication that he's going to be counsel for the board during deliberation.
He's counsel for the board in the application process. He's the city attorney. He's present. They make application. They deny it. They exercise their rights to a hearing with hearing officer Bud. Mr. Yendez appears and conducts the hearing. He's opposing counsel to Mr. Worley's attorneys, Mr. Kreitz and Mr. Meyer, in that respect. They never objected. The hearing went on for 5 days or however many days they took the evidence. A record exists. A transcript was requested, and it was prepared and provided our board. There's no objection to Mr. Yendez proceeding in that capacity. Then we get back to the board for their decision. Again, Mr. Yendez is the city's attorney, just as in Cochran.
So in this case, if we, you know, there's been no objection, but if we were to invite one of you to come back in the robing room with us and in the decision room and advise us as we deliberate about this case, what is that any different than what happened here? And would there need to be a prior objection to that before?
There needs to be some evidence. What we have is discovery in the circuit court. With due respect, as I understand the cases on this, it says if that attorney wears multiple hats, the key issue is there a right to appeal that decision? And yes, there is.
And why would we defer to that? I mean, but aren't we doing a contested case review of this? There was a hearing, there were counsel and so forth. And when we do that, because you've had the basics of due process at the administrative level, and so the circuit court reviews the record. How can we say that when the same counsel represented both one of the parties and and advised the decision maker ex parte?
For two reasons. There was never an objection made, and there was an appeal right subsequent from that decision made.
But I'm talking about the procedure that's set up here.
Right, the procedure.
How can that be compliant with due process, or how can this be properly considered under a contested case review if that is the procedure that's followed, as opposed to apparently some other It would be maybe under some other non-contested review. But it was,
And for the third reason, one more reason, is that there was limited discovery in the circuit court case, and these members of the board were asked specifically, did you have any discussion, Mr. Yendez, outside the record, and they said no.
He was in the room as they were deliberating and advising them, right?
He was in the room at the time he came out, and Mr. Kreitz was outside with his client. When they made their ultimate decision, I don't know.
He came out and advised them of that decision.
He told them that the board had decided, yes.
And that was prior to they had the hearing with Mr. Worley in the hearing. They sent Mr. Worley out. They stayed in that room, and within 20 minutes, while he's in there in that room the whole time, he came out and told them what the decision was.
Right, just as in Cochran. He's counseled them on a number of matters, not just this matter. And he's in there as their attorney, and that's his presence. That's correct.
Regardless of this case, can you address the legal appropriateness of that situation, or whether or not you need to have a conflict counsel in that kind of situation, some other counsel, or even though, of course, he can represent both parties, is there any authority that he can in the same case and that we should accord some deference?
I think that was referenced in my brief. That's
well, can you explain to me why that's in accord with due process, please?
It's in accord with due process. The cases that I've cited in the brief is because there's an appeal right further from that decision.
And how do we know what went on in reaching that decision? I mean, what arguments were made, what counsel was given, and so forth. How do we know?
There's no evidence there was any argument made by counsel.
Are you suggesting that when he's back there, that they're in executive session deciding matters other than the appeal of the hearing officer?
He's performing his role on behalf of the board, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and that there may have been other things going on other than this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so far as you know, there's no record, although it may look bad, there's no record that he was asked any questions about this case.
Absolutely, and that's what Judge Heller explored in the circuit court. He allowed discovery to ask, was there anything outside the record asked of Mr. Yendez and Mr. Yendez, and they said no.
So the record before the trial judge is then that he might have been in there, but he wasn't asked any questions about this particular case.
What about this report that was submitted that you said was covered by attorney-client privilege had to do with this case? Is that correct?
I submitted it as an attorney-client privilege document to Judge Heller under seal.
But it was prepared by counsel, by Mr. Yendez, and given to the decision makers, and the other party was not allowed to see it. Is that correct?
Right. We claimed it was a
why is that okay?
It was a communication between the board and its attorney.
I understand.
And I presented it in sealed and said, Judge, this is attorney-client communications. This doesn't have anything to do with the record being made by Mr. Mullen or claiming.
Can you see why I have a problem with someone who's representing the opposing side submitting things ex parte and under seal to the judge, and because he's wearing two hats and the other side not being able to see it? So is that procedurally not a problem?
That was
for an independent decision maker?
That was not raised with the appellate court. That was not
but
raised
I'm asking
here. It wasn't preserved to address, but Judge Heller reviewed it in camera and agreed it was an attorney-client communication. Like I said, there are other matters pending before the board.
But that's not what this report was on this case, though, right?
Yeah.
It was privileged document, but there are other matters pending before the board.
Except that this matter was decided during that period.
Mr. Yendez relayed the decision to the attorneys for Mr. Worley.
And there was no time it could have been decided between the end of the meeting when
he was there. The
he
whole
was
time.
Going, and they were presenting information to the board, and when the decision was communicated.
That's beyond me. That's the mental processes of the board, how they made
was
their decision.
Was he in the room the whole time? So, I mean, they didn't retire to a different room to make their decision. He was in there with them, and he came out with their decision. Is that
actually, they started the decision process in March. Mr. Yendez provided them the record from Judge Heller in March. I think we submitted affidavits. That's the transcript that was not attached, but that was the hearing that Judge Budd heard and made available for the board. They tabled it to review the record. Then in April, they came back with their decision. Their decision reflects that after having considered the record, here's their decision. Mr. Yendez is there on behalf of the board doing his job as their counsel. They relay to him the decision. He tells Mr. Worley and his attorneys outside, this is the board's decision.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
When you went to the hearing, when the hearing officer heard the case and made some findings of fact, and so there was there a transcript made that was produced for the board for that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was at the time. So when Mr. Yendez and the counsel for Mr. Worley came before the board, was that in the nature of an oral argument, or was there further evidence?
No, sir. There was no further evidence. There was no. My understanding is that the transcript was provided in March to see what the board would decide. The board decided then to table their decision so they could review the record. And they waited till April. Then they told of their decision, and then their decision was prepared, and they signed it, I think, May.
And in the course of the decision of, and perhaps I should be asking opposing counsel, did the decision made by the board, the written decision of the board, include any factual matters that are outside the record that was produced before the hearing examiner?
No, Your Honor. In fact, they were specific. They said after their review of the record from Judge Budge's decision, that's what they decided.
Who prepared the board's decision?
I suspect Mr. Yendez did. I suspect he did. But that's at their direction, and they reviewed and they signed. That's what they did. And that's wearing, again, you're right, Cochran, he's wearing multiple hats. He prepared the decision. But they decided that there's no evidence that he contributed in any way in their decision other than in his role.
And in Cochran, that's an Eastern District case. It's not a Supreme Court case.
Right. You're exactly right. And I think I cited a couple more cases. I was looking at it from the aspect, and you had asked that question, you know, where do you appeal this? What happens? My understanding, it goes back to the board. But in these cases, they tell me in review of these administrative decisions based on deference to the board and their decision authority that if this multiple attorney hat role is played, the importance of due process is that there would be another appeal route in the event they don't agree. And that's what we've been through.
But given all the aspects of what's attorney-client privilege, what's, what was said or not said, what representations were made, it probably could have been a not too difficult process for the board to say, you're not participating on this issue. We're going to hire another attorney who will advise us on what the record was.
I agree.
You participated at the hearing. You cannot tell us what to do at this decision process. That would have been hard.
You know, and that's the reason why the appropriateness would be, if an attorney feels like this is improper, you raise that objection at the very first opportunity, so it's preserved. Say, wait a minute. If you're in there while they're deliberating, I object. I want to be in there too. That brings it nothing like that.
Let me ask you the question this way.
Yes, sir.
Everybody keeps saying there was deliberations on this particular day, but isn't it just as plausible that they came to the meeting with their decision already made? These groups get these findings and they review them all and they vote. I mean,
yes, Your Honor.
Apparently we don't have any record, but based on no record at all, isn't it just as fair to assume that they already had it when they got there? I mean, it wasn't like somebody called the clerk in and had them type it, is there?
That's exactly right.
But even if without that, they believed he was their attorney and he gave them information that they're claiming was privileged because he was their attorney, that was information prior to them making a decision.
Perhaps I could supplement you that in-camera document. I'd be happy to do that if that would be helpful. I've got it in my office. I marked it. Judge Heller looked at it, and it is a document of what an attorney in his role on behalf of a board does. There are a number of other cases. And
well, they go into executive session, they have to pass a motion. Before the body, Sunshine Law, they have to pass a motion before they go into an executive session, which details what they're going to be talking about, or the subjects they'll be talking about.
They have more cases than Mr. Worley, yes, Your Honor.
But did they note that in their motion that they passed to go into executive session that we will be discussing these cases, but not Worley's case?
Oh, for Sunshine Law purposes, I don't know.
That's required by the Sunshine Law.
I'm sure
they're going
into
executive session. They must say what the personnel matters, whatever. They have to have a motion saying we're going to discuss personnel matters, they could have said we're not going to discuss Walters' case.
They had a number of matters, and he was there as their counsel for a number of matters.
And well, they didn't pass that motion. Are they then exempt from the Sunshine Law? If they didn't pass the motion saying they are going to executive session to discuss issues that are exempt from the Sunshine Law, like personnel matters.
I presume
they didn't
did.
Pass that. Are they then liable under the Sunshine Law to disclose their, to be in the Sunshine?
That's not been touched in any of this. I'm not that adept to go back right now and tell you for sure exactly, but I presume they did.
You referred to Judge Heller. Our brief showed Judge Darnold.
It did. It went to Judge Heller first, and Judge Heller decided this matter of judicial review of their decision in favor of the board, but the petition had two other counts, and so technically it was not final. The third count was judicial review. It had a constitutionality count one, then a second count, and it languished. Judge Heller retired. He's very happy in eminence, riding canoes. And so he left, and we needed another judge to get it final. We got Judge Darnold appointed in his absence. Mr. Mullen filed his brief for summary judgment on the remaining counts, and I did as well. And Judge Darnold reviewed those in favor of the board. And that's how we got to this posture. Count two, Mr. Mullen dismissed. So we were just constitutionality and then the judicial review aspect.
Right. Then the merits.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Now, when was your earliest opportunity to object or raise your... Now, at the hearing, you may not have had an idea that Yolandis might have been able to be disqualified before the board. When was your earliest opportunity to object, and when did you object to this procedure?
I wasn't there, first of all, but as near as I can tell from the record, the first hint that they had that there was some kind of participation between Yolandis and the board was when they were asked to leave, and they stood outside and watched it happen.
Did they object
well,
at that point?
Well, do we know? You said they stood outside and watched it happen. One of my concerns here goes along with Judge Fisher's is how do we know what happened? I mean, do we know what happened in there? Is it a matter of record?
It is not.
And I mean, what we know is
yes.
They were in there. They saw the attorney in there. Then he came out. We know.
They saw them talking back and forth.
I mean, in a sense, you don't have a lot of proof here.
Well, and the reason I don't is because they objected to attorney-client privilege when I wanted to depose Yolandis.
Well, but let's get, and you know, we're past all that. We're here today, and you understand it's your burden to demonstrate this violation of due process, and they produced this in camera at request to the trial court, and here we are to make this decision. It's been very generous of him to make that offer, but do you understand the basic premise that when you're appealing, you're supposed to give us enough to make our decision? And if you don't, you know, the burden's on you. We don't sit here and guess a constitutional violation based on nothing. And if the trial court had this in camera and reviewed it, why shouldn't we sit here and think, well, obviously, there's no smoke, there's no fire?
That's true.
Is there anything in the written decision of the board that makes reference to anything that was not considered in the factual hearing before the hearing examiner?
Yolandis' brief.
No, factual.
Yolandis' brief had all the summary of facts. The only thing that
but
we
were the facts in Yolandis' brief, facts that were presented to the hearing examiner.
Yes.
Isn't it okay to adopt the language of one of the party's briefs in your decision?
I think that it is, so long as the other side has an opportunity to respond.
You didn't have an opportunity to file a brief?
We filed a brief, and it did not get in the record before the board.
Why is that?
Because they didn't put it in. The only reason I can think of. And once again, my ability...
These are briefs filed before the hearing examiner?
That is correct.
Okay.
The document that there was in camera review of, is that the legal update dated March 3rd, 04?
Yes, ma'am.
And so that's the document that they acknowledge was given to them that they claim attorney-client privilege.
That is correct.
And Are you claiming that there were verbal communications also? Do I understand that the commissioners were deposed later and said there were not any additional verbal communications?
I was not able to depose any persons in the circuit court action. I was able to submit interrogatories that the judge had approved. The interrogatories I initially filed, they objected to basically all of them on attorney-client. Judge said, okay, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to craft interrogatories that they can answer. Those are the judge's interrogatories, not mine.
And they, and in response to those, what did the commissioners say?
They said that nothing was communicated to them outside the record except the legal update.
Some of them said they didn't recall.
Yeah, some said they didn't recall. Those that said they did remember said that it was a legal update, said that Yendez was present during the board meetings. The sort of overarching issue to me is, and I know this court has gone to great lengths in prior cases because I've read them, to avoid the appearance of impropriety in the legal system. And if ever there was one that had the appearance of impropriety to it, it would certainly be this one. And if it doesn't appear to be totally shocking to anybody but me, it does to other attorneys that are involved in administrative law. Clients may
but
not
you're
know
making it. A constitutional objection, and when was the, did you do it in a timely fashion?
I entered the case, I think, in October or November of 05 and filed the second amended petition raising the constitutional allegations in December 05. It took me a little while to figure out what was going on.
But it was raised in the circuit court, and the explanation was that was the first opportunity to raise it was in the circuit court because it occurred during the deliberative process of the board.
That is correct. And there was no objection made at that time when I filed the amended pleading.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. The case is taken under submission.